Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Alain Guillaumard. I'm the director of the European Institute, and it's a pleasure for me to welcome you this evening to listen to two guests here, Lord Dahrendorf and Hugo Young. This is the first of a series of lectures which are going to take place over the coming academic year here at the school, which is a cooperation between the European Institute and People's Europe. As I said, I will say very few words, in fact, about two guests this evening, Lord Dahrendorf, who will be chairing this lecture, who needs very little introduction, apart from the fact that maybe, amongst other activities, he was one of our director here at the school, and of course, amongst many of his publications, has published the history of the 100 years of existence of the London School of Economics and, of course, Political Science. As far as Hugo Young is concerned, again, here, very few words of introductions, but I will leave this to Lord Dahrendorf. Before I leave the stage, and what I have to say is not actually all that interesting compared to what you're going to be listening to very, very soon, I'd like to leave the floor to Paul Anderson, who will tell you a few words about People's Europe. I hope you will enjoy this lecture. And Paul, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Alain. I really am going to say a few words, and they are simply to explain. People's Europe was a very large conference that was held here at the school last summer, and it involved a vast array of non-governmental organizations, essentially an umbrella group. A number of people on the organizing committee decided that it would be a good idea to keep the process going because the conference was such a success, and this lecture series is a result of that decision. Now, what we want to do is keep in touch with everybody and inform them of the forthcoming events. We were hoping to have the whole thing sorted out by now, but we haven't for various reasons. So if you haven't given your name and address to people, or if you're not on the mailing list already, fill in one of the cards that are available on the desk outside and put them in the box. We'll be in touch. Okay, thank you.
Right, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ralph Dahrendorf, and I'm merely the, whatever, the referee. We hardly need a referee, do we? But it does give me great pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight. If there's anything the European debate needs, it is a little sophistication. I suppose what I mean by that is information about facts and thoughtful comments on these facts. Comments which may or may not take sides, but which in any case use arguments which are based on a pretty shrewd knowledge of what's going on and some consideration of the implications. If there's one person in this country who can offer such sophistication, it is actually our speaker tonight, Hugo Young. He has offered it already. Hugo Young is a very distinguished journalist and author. He's been working for the Sunday Times, dare I say the old Sunday Times, for
emphatically.
nearly 20 years in various capacities as a leader writer, as a deputy editor. And in the last 15 years, he's been with The Guardian, and his columns in The Guardian are very widely read and debated, but he's not just written and he's not just writing regular columns. He's published a number of books, and two of them, I think, have had a particular impact on public debate. One is his book about the Thatcher world, One of Us, It's actually remained a phrase which a degree of tribalism has survived that particular government in the politics of the country. One of us, and then there is the more recent, and I have to say, just absolutely wonderful study of the European debate in Britain entitled This Blessed Plot. And it is in this area that we expect something from him today. Perhaps he'll even tell us what happened in that other theatre this morning, or in the cinema, or wherever it was. But above all, we want to hear what he has to tell us about dismantling Euroscepticism. I have to warn you, there won't be an awful lot of time afterwards, but I very much hope that there will be an opportunity for a few questions and comments from the floor. First of all, it is my pleasure to introduce Hugo Young.
Thank you, Lord Dahrendorf. As you heard, this lecture is the first in a series, and it addresses the one great question that Britain has to answer as this century ends. The date's been in my diary for quite a long time, many months. I think perhaps Nina Fishman, who organised this occasion, was the only person who knew, even before the Prime Minister, that the event in the IMAX cinema was going to take place this very day. But it's a coincidence I'm very happy to live with. There are many problems in the public realm which politicians spend a lot of time talking about and trying to solve. Schools, the health service, welfare budget, pension provision, crime. These are the daily challenges of governments from west to east and right to left. They're part of the endless grind of maintaining a civilized society, and they're very, very important. One thing we know for certain about them, though, is that they will never finally be solved. There's no such thing as a final solution to health provision. These are big and pervasive problems, but they hardly qualify as great questions. A great question is concrete, definitive, existential for the nation, and it has, at some stage, to be decided one way or the other. Whether Britain is to be at the heart of the European Union is a great question. Could there be a bigger one? It asks something large about the future of the nation, and it's also capable of a final answer. That answer, moreover, should be requested soon. Compared with the promised referendum on Sterling's disappearance into the euro, every other public argument is insignificant. The LSE and People's Europe are surely right to promote a series of lectures that tries to recognise this. And a newspaper columnist can only be flattered to be asked to give the first. Contrary to the columnist's credo, there are some things it takes more than 1,000 words to say. It is, I candidly admit, unfortunate that a series of lectures on Britain in Europe has to begin this way. There should be more important things to think about than whether Britain really belongs there. Who can survey the scene in the EU today? A divided French government, a disastrously weakened German government, a general absence of leadership, and not regret the opportunity which Britain is missing. How stimulating it would be to discuss the positive contribution Britain could now be making at the head of the field to EU reform, EU democratisation, EU employment, and all the rest of the things. We could be considering whether, in the light of enlargement, the EU needs to take a radically new direction. There's a mass of problems which are in need of creative thought. But that would be a truly academic lecture. It's part of the British predicament that on such-like issues, London's voice is unimportant and will become ever less important so long as the fundamental question is not finally decided. And that Britain's internal debate, too, is hopelessly impoverished because it hasn't been. So, let's cast forward a few years. Prime Minister Blair has been comfortably re-elected. It is, shall we say, 2002. The referendum is underway. It's not a referendum the public have asked for. To most voters, the euro is a complicated business of the kind they thought they elected politicians to take care of. The average voter in Sedgefield or Richmond or Dunfermline or Wokingham doesn't spend time puzzling over exchange rate theory or gauging the consequences for British exports of asymmetrical inflation targets. Nor is the referendum happening because politicians have decided that the public should brace up and, as a matter of grand principle, get interested in these questions prior to an irreversible decision. It's happening, as we all know, because of a political fix both parties made before the last election. On the scenario which I'm proposing, an election which has seen the routing of the party that made anti-Europeanism its only clear and distinguishing policy, the first effect of the referendum is to set at nothing that result. It asks for a rerun. Strange commentary, you might think, on the worth of parliamentary democracy in the eyes of some of the people who believe its uniqueness is what distinguishes Britain's system from those to be found anywhere else in Europe. But we'll let that pass. There will be, there has to be, a referendum. What will it be about? It may begin by being about the technical question on the paper. Should we change our monetary arrangements and join the euro? Doubtless there will be fine scrutinies of trade flows past and future, and learned arguments about whether one interest rate can ever suit Britain and Germany, not to mention Greece. The voters of Britain will be invited to examine the state of the French economy, the Irish economy, Danish economy perhaps, and consider the forward prospects outlined in 100 different learned papers as to the decisive relevance of this evidence for an independent British monetary policy. But before long, these conundrums will recede. They will have been drowned out before the referendum has even started. Perhaps they already are no more than proxies for the real battle. The argument will have become political, not just political, but existential. And this for two reasons. First, the economic case is essentially unprovable either way. Although there can be a rational discussion about timing, nobody can get nearer than striking a balance of economic possibilities. There are persuasive reasons for expecting, without being certain, that Britain's economic performance would improve when inside the completed single market that a single currency zone makes more efficient. Equally, there are persuasive, but not decisive, reasons for anxiety that a single interest rate covering 15 economies will bring some difficult problems. In this matter, I belong to the Mervyn King school. Mr. King, the Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, said it would be 200 years before an intellectually sound statement of the final economic consequences of the euro could be safely ventured. This seems to me a less than resounding basis on which to come out fighting for a no vote now. But it reminds one of the level of agnosticism that is appropriate. That hasn't deterred the prophets of Euroscepticism from making the most adamant assertions about the inevitable disaster the euro would bring. Nor has it dissuaded the government from sticking to its five economic tests, as if the passing of these will represent proof positive that all our anxieties can be laid to rest. There never will be such proof either way. These claims on certainty from both sides, as they both know, already have the covert purpose of disguising the politics in the economics. For Gordon Brown, holding us in suspense as we await his oracular pronouncement on the five tests, the economics excuse him from engaging with the other issues. For Eurosceptics, asserting that the economics are impossible is a convenient way of not addressing their contradictions and confusions about the political destiny of Britain and Europe. The second reason why the euro, pure and simple, will not be the referendum issue is that the British public will soon understand that this cannot be what the discussion is all about. They'll see through the fastidious pretense that this is all about whether our currency should be put in the pot with a lot of other currencies for the greater good of the British and European economies. Whatever the outcome of the referendum, the declaration it makes will be much more momentous. If the answer is yes, the British will have opted to be a fully functioning player in the destiny of Europe. That decision may have taken Britain 30 years of nominal EU membership to brood about, trying the patience of her partners and chronically losing influence among them. But it will, I think, be final. The resolution of the plot that we kept losing for 5 decades. If the answer is no, well, what then? The decision will be equally momentous. But to what end exactly? What will it mean? Something larger than a technical decision to stand back from this incidental little folly called economic and monetary union. But what? To ask the question immediately invites an inquiry into the real object of the Eurosceptic rage that now surrounds us, an interrogation which many sceptics have spared themselves and have certainly withheld from the wider world. If Britain says no, some immediate consequences are indisputable. We will remain indefinitely outside the Euro 11 Committee of ECOFIN and renounce any role in the European Central Bank. Actually, the Euro 11 will probably by then be the Euro 14, as Denmark, Sweden and Greece look set to join before 2002. They will begin to have some of the coherence of an economic government in our largest trading area. Only marginally less immediate will be the changed perceptions of the international economic world. Business and government in the US, in Japan, the rest of the EU, which presently make investment decisions on the basis that sterling is fully expected to join the euro, will change their assessment. Now indulged as a pre-in, Britain will be downgraded to the category of a forever out. For this, let's be clear, will not be a temporary decision. Those who ask for it and win it will say it's final. The prevarication will be over. The nation will have made a great political statement of rejection of the project to which the EU has devoted itself with great seriousness and at times much anxious difficulty for a decade. Anyone who thinks the outcome will be confined to the matter of the currency is seriously deluded. It'll be the start of a great distancing. Both in Europe and on the offshore island, every other aspect of Britain's European aspirations will be called in question. Leave aside the domestic consequences for a Prime Minister thus defeated, which will weaken him, perhaps terminally. His entire European agenda will be destroyed. For the triumph of the No campaign would be a victory for the party that has opposed every part of that agenda. The European Defence Initiative? Forget it. More qualified majority voting in the environment and CAP and other public interest questions, washed away in the anti-Europe declaration that has just been solemnly made. A future for the collegial behaviour, the prudent give and take with which Mr. Blair has, to the substantial benefit of this country, replaced the warrior stance of the Thatcher Major years, mistook for a negotiating position. The great roar of rejection the British people had been induced to give by their vote in the referendum would obliterate it. This is the scenario to which a significant part of the body politic is now looking forward. It's relentlessly propounded by a majority of the press and has been for the best part of a decade. It's the declared position of the second major official party. It has the country supposedly in its grip and therefore has the government thoroughly alarmed. A no vote for the euro, subsumed into a declaration that the EU on its present trajectory is no longer for Britain, is the expectation that shadows, even dominates, our politics. Yet who are the prophets of this case? Here are the people who offer themselves as the true leaders of public opinion, beacons of principle and patriotism, standing against the conspiracy that is Europe and the misbegotten policies of British crypto-federalists for the last 30 years. They propose themselves as honest John Bull politicians ranged against the duplicities of establishments and governments, an image lovingly filled in by editors and journalists who, having long abandoned objective reporting, agree with them. They've got away with this self-definition for a long time. It deserves more serious scrutiny than it's usually had. Both their record and their reasoning undermine, and I would argue dismantle, many skeptics' claim to credibility. They shouldn't be given exemption from the normal rules of intellectual integrity. First, they mostly have a past which they prefer to forget. Just as William Hague opposes the euro as a matter of principle, but only for another 6 or 7 years, many of his predecessors now talk about the European Union with a loathing that could easily distract one from the fact that as ministers not long ago, they strode its corridors, worked its committees, and offered not a single indication that this was a world from which they wished to depart. The list is long, and I won't weary you with a litany. Many of today's anti-Europeans were strongly in favour of Britain's entry into the common market. Norman Lamont worked for it. Bill Cash supported it. David Owen left the Labour leadership and then the Labour Party on account of it. These were not ignorant Europeans. They seemed to know exactly what it meant. As a young man, my friend Bill was deluging his lawyer friends with letters reminding them, as a pro-European, that the Treaty of Rome, when it came into force, would constitute a superior law over English law. Now his faction in the Tory Party regards that as an unpardonable attack on British independence. Likewise, Norman Lamont asks us to understand, requests our sympathy, for heaven's sake, that he only found out what the founders and builders of the European community really meant when he was negotiating, as Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Treaty of Maastricht. They do not seem, these people, to be men of very solid judgment. But they're models of judicious complacency compared with Margaret Thatcher. Here was the leader who took Britain further into Europe than any leader since Ted Heath. She did admittedly conduct a form of warfare against Brussels. But her record, based on negotiating tactics brilliantly summarized by Douglas Hurd in the three words, no, no, yes, is thoroughly integrationist. She half invented and enthusiastically signed the Single European Act. She presided over the curtailment of national vetoes. She approved Britain's entry into the ERM. She did not dissent at the time from a verdict on the Treaty of Maastricht, apparent throughout the Tory press, which found the Daily Mail, for example, looking forward to the single currency as one day, in its words, worth having, and to Britain playing its part in what the Mail called shaping an ever closer European Union. These are unrecognizable sentiments today. Lady Thatcher has become leader of the faction that scapegoats Europe as the source of every British problem and puts the exit option on the table. Confronted by her record on the Single European Act, all she can do is retreat into paranoia, another habit that should make anyone question her right to be taken seriously. The most famous small print scrutineer ever to occupy Downing Street now says that the Foreign Office misled her. She now repudiates, as do so many once serious Tory politicians, the beliefs and the actions of a long career. Does this matter? Aren't all politicians entitled, as Keynes said, to change their minds? That may be so when the facts change. The European Union, I agree, has certainly evolved. But it has always been about some form of ever closer union. And that is why some people always opposed it. The treaties are clear. The process, while ebbing and flowing, has had momentum built into it. and Britain, though seldom behaving like a keen member of the club, has acquiesced in every development. All these people's allegiance to Europe, moreover, was something far beyond a brief youthful experiment with an improper relationship. The fact that so many have totally deserted it raises doubts about their character. These are fickle souls, yet they prate about eternal British verities. With their heavy righteousness, they're attacking other people's errors, but more to the point, in my view, repenting of their own. They seem to be working out their own guilt, the consequences of what they still decline to confess to have been their own misjudgments, by doing their best to wreck the European settlement that most other people take as a given. Well, I'm sorry, but however fervent the revisionist case they now make, this record should not be quietly forgotten or forgiven, as all part of some political game where everyone is allowed to change sides with impunity. And what is this case, the revisionist case? That's the second question about which Euroscepticism, on clouds of patriotic fervour, has had an easy ride. It needs to be brought down into the real world. Now, the great rejection which I spoke of, which is the object of Eurosceptic politics now, is not unimaginable. A fundamental realignment of Britain's position might be possible. Such admissions that for 25 years a country has been going down the wrong road are admittedly unusual. But there is a case to make which says that integration has had its day, that fragmentation makes more sense, that whether or not Europe sees this, Britain must, that Britain should no longer be tied to the political and economic dinosaur that Europe is. Head for the open sea, perhaps, or become the 51st state, or go it alone as a Hong Kong-type entrepot reborn on the west and not the east of the Eurasian landmass. Certainly can be said, and the Tory MP Michael Spicer, for example, has said it, that there is, as he said, a fundamental difference in the philosophy which lies behind the British Constitution and those of her continental partners. Which means, as he would argue, it seems, this union between us is heading for ruin. Now, this is serious stuff. It's breathtakingly ambitious. It's saying something very, very large. If true, it needs working out in great and careful detail. Yet if you scour the Eurosceptic literature, you will find nothing that measures up. The pamphlets and polemics have been torrential in the decade when this movement has grown. Critiques abound of every aspect of the Union, of Brussels, of the Court, the Parliament, the Commission. Ridicule and hatred pour forth daily from the press. But the academic, let alone political utterances, seldom reach the bottom of the great question. There are glancing proposals for this or that. Withdraw from the Court, repatriate the powers, repeal the Single European Act, restore the supremacy of the House of Commons, and now veto any treaty that does not include a clause providing for serial opt-outs for every member that fancies them. All those things have been said by leading conservative politicians in recent years. But there is a startling indifference to consequences. They haven't begun to consult with the collaborators, American or European, who might be needed to give this picture some credibility. They've said nothing constructive to the British people, whose destiny they're playing with, beyond the hot air about giving you back your country, as the leader told the recent Tory party conference. They want entirely to remake Britain's relationship with Europe, but I doubt they've thought about it in detail, even around Mr. Hague's kitchen table. For such an ambitious proposition, this is a pitiful intellectual record, especially coming from a party which has been able to think about nothing else but Europe for the last 5 years. It says something larger about Euroscepticism across the field, a doctrine which, the more you look at it, is shot through with what can charitably be called contradiction and wishful thinking, or, less charitably, double talk and deception. There are different schools. Some reject the case for the stakes being as serious as I describe them. David Owen is one of these. He and his friends think the argument can be confined to the narrow technicality. They want Britain to be fully of Europe, but they never want the euro. Let's do them the favour of saying they're honest about this and do not have a wider agenda. That isn't all that easy with David Owen, who turns out to be even more opposed to a common foreign and security policy than he is to the euro. But some of his allies think it's enough to reject the euro as an economic cuckoo in the nest, which would suck the life out of British economic independence, and whose rejection would have no other impact on a happy relationship with Europe that will then proceed quite undamaged through the 21st century. What these people want is for the referendum not to be held. They think that this is the best way of ensuring Britain does not enter the euro without putting to the test their own claim to have nothing in common with Rupert Murdoch and the coarse, mendacious europhobes he lets loose in the sun. They fear the contest either way. They know Mr. Blair might win it. They half understand that if he loses, Britain would be spitting in the face of their own soi-disant Europeanism. So their strategy is to join those who want to scare the Prime Minister away from his chosen course. They want to have it both ways and think this can best be done by putting off the choice in perpetuity. That is an unpersuasive piece of prophecy. It neglects the fact that a referendum postponed at some stage takes on the features of a referendum lost. We may not be able to say when that moment is. Most people I ask, especially in financial circles here and on the mainland, set roughly another 4 years as the outer limit of Britain still being seen as a pre-in. After that, she will begin to be treated as a country in the course of preparing not to join, with all that flowed from that. In the real world, the moment would, I think, be sharper. If the government decided, after this next election, not to hold the referendum soon, everyone would start to know it did not intend to hold it later, closer to the next election. The Owen diagnosis is therefore a pretense. The honest longing, perhaps, of those who see many defects in the single currency, but the deluded aspiration of people who are not prepared to face reality, that if the choice for the euro is not made, Britain will be on course for exclusion, first from the engine room and then from the deck of the European Union. Does the Conservative Party more clearly want this? Here we enter a realm obscured until recently by mists of confusion, insincerity, and subterfuge. It's become a little bit clearer in the last few days. But shadowy figures still say what they do not mean, evade what they apparently believe, or play politics with a position they believe to be popular, but whose ultimate logic they know will be so unpopular that they dare not confront it. Some Tories sincerely do not want Britain to leave the European Union. A representative figure is William Cash. Bill will refer you to his writings and speeches, more copious on this subject than anyone else alive or dead, and remark that nowhere has he ever urged exit. And he's right. He wants Britain to stay in. And so, I'm sure, does William Hague. Mr. Hague cannot be anything if he's not ambitious. And he knows that even the Tory party that survives under him, let alone the party as it used to be, and must one day hope to be again, would not tolerate a commitment to exit, and nor would the voters. Other Tories, more fiercely but no more explicitly, betray the body language of exiteers. I'm not now thinking of John Biffin, Teddy Taylor, and the small band of principled heroes who have said no from day one, and have sometimes sacrificed political careers as a result. But Ian Duncan Smith, a shadow minister, promoted a bill to, quote, disapply to the UK the judgments, rules and doctrines of the European Court of Justice. John Redwood has ceased even to pretend that Europe has anything to offer Britain. Michael Portillo will plainly be happy to embrace every consequence of winning the life or death struggle, as he sees it, against membership of the euro. These people would, I venture, be delighted to see Britain exclude herself forever, a possibility rendered more available if the euro should visibly collapse. The Conservative policy is heavily contingent on the one economic fact that would, if it happened, be unambiguous: the disintegration of an economic zone to which Britain sends more than half her exports. Ostensibly, the Tory leader doesn't have a policy that leads to exit. Only thus can one explain the logical absurdities he's prepared to defend. He says the euro would drain Britain of her bodily fluids, both economic and political. Keeping out is a matter of principle, yet unlike most matters of principle, one that is strictly time-limited. It all could change, he seems to say, within the decade. Only someone terrified of the thought of staying out forever, and at least half aware of the compromised membership of the EU this would lead to, could endure the embarrassment of defending such a contradiction. But actually, Mr. Hague is saying something similar to exit. The only difference is that his message is more insidious because it pretends otherwise. The line now is there must be a renegotiation of the founding Treaty of Rome to make it possible for members to pick and choose what they get committed to. This is an adventurous idea. No other country wants to renegotiate the treaties. Nobody else is seeking a major onslaught against the court, the commission, or the parliament. It will be a case of one against the rest, though one of the strands of Tory thinking is somehow that such a process would supposedly bring the whole of Europe to its senses, persuading many other member states to see the need for the EU to rebuild itself, as the Daily Telegraph said recently, on a completely different basis. But if the other 14 do not do that, let's be clear what will happen. In August, one ginger group, Conservatives Against a Federal Europe, shortened to CAFE, said in the event of failure there would be an obvious option, which is withdrawal. True enough. But Mr. Hague slapped them down at the very suggestion, leaving quite unclear what his own fallback position will be when this renegotiation fails to meet all, or perhaps any, of his demands. One does not have the sense of this being mere reticence, so as not to reveal the cunning negotiator's hand. It's the silence of a leader who, having bared his chest, has no idea what he will say when he's knocked to the floor with the first well-aimed continental punch. There's only one word for this approach, and the word may be surprising. I call it frivolity. Behind the tumult and the shouting of Eurosceptic politicians is a terrible lack of seriousness. They know what they're against, but are unable to convey any idea of what they're for. They don't even admit the obligation to do so. Reviewing my book on the history, which Lord Dyrendorf mentioned, Michael Portillo sounded quite incredulous that anyone should ask the question or press him for an answer. Are we obliged to submit an option other than survival against the suggestion that our nation state should be wound up? Was the alpha and omega of his comment. He belongs to a long line of senior Tory ministers who have been driven by the issue of Europe to desert the most fundamental norm of the politician's transaction with the voter: intellectual clarity. You can see this in the numerous apostasies which I briefly referred to. You see it also in the contemporary critique, there are so many to choose from, in which Mr. Hague and his people, for example, assault the European Central Bank because it is politically unaccountable, an affront to democracy, as some of them say, and yet they will fight to the last breath against anything that brings more democratic accountability to the European Union. This record is not commensurate with the task which Euroscepticism has set itself. What you find when you scan the rhetoric are not coherent arguments taken to their conclusion, but the working out of a prior visceral prejudice. Now, I'm not saying, of course, that there are no economic arguments against joining the euro. There are plenty, just as there are plenty on the other side. It's a risky project, being conducted in a world which is risky in many different ways. Not least for Britain, the risk attached to being a small, fluctuating currency squeezed between the dollar and the euro. All this can be rationally, though perhaps not conclusively, debated. But the procedure of most Eurosceptic discourse is different. It's a struggle, by every means available, to escape from the European context that's been the axiom of British policy for a quarter century. Somewhere along the line, different times for different people, no doubt, the urge for disengagement, no matter what it costs, has taken over. Ancestral voices speak louder than future interest. The mystic chords of memory overwhelm the sense that the British identity could gain, not lose, by incorporating a European dimension. And any opportunist argument will do. Sometimes it's about the pound, ignoring every argument the other way. Sometimes it's about British independence, refusing to address the myriad ways Britain already is not independent. Sometimes some of it's done by distraction. The large case, for example, important one, that the euro was the wrong priority in the first place, as if this disposes of the reality which the euro has become, and therefore the need for Britain to decide whether or not she wants to be at the centre of the European Union. Or else, the case that the Parliament and the Commission need reforming, as if these were conclusive reasons for Britain to back out rather than to be an active reforming influence. Or, most triumphantly of all, the dishonest sceptic's hand-wringing, head-shaking contention that while he or she is a lifelong European who speaks Italian like a native, all further integration of the European Union will be hopelessly divisive among the British people and must therefore be resisted. I call this lecture Dismantling Euroscepticism. Before I finish, I want to say just a word about building Europeanism, the other side of the euro. My case is that for far too long, pro-Europe politics in Britain has been defensive. Some deeply flawed opponents, begging every question and ignoring most lessons of a 50-year history, have got away with intellectual murder and been allowed to control an agenda that digs deep into the past and not the future. But the friends of this project are prone to similar mistakes. They also hesitate. On the brink of the euro, they want to hold back and, I've sometimes read, reconsider where Europe is going, how its flaws can be corrected, whether a whole new fresh start shouldn't be attempted before we, the British, get further involved. Shouldn't the vision be recast? Doesn't the reshaping of Europe after the end of the Cold War demand a radical rethink of the EU? How should we respond to enlargement? Do we think the Germans will ever cut their welfare bills, and so on? These are fair questions. But coming from British pro-Europeans at this juncture, they are self-indulgent retreats from the only question that is pressing. An alibi for not deciding that question. They're the musings of the senior common room, suddenly inflicted on the pro-Europe argument by professors who have failed to grasp the scale of what's at stake in their own country, or the urgency with which the decision has to be made. If we wait until they're answered, before at last placing ourselves incontestably at the centre of Europe, we will never get there. If we do that, I don't mind saying that we will have run away from a destiny that has become inevitable. People do not like the inevitability argument. It was treated with some distaste at the launch of Britain in Europe this morning at the IMAX Theatre. It bothers Tony Blair in Downing Street. He is conscious that the case hitherto, over three decades, has had to rely on it, that somehow there's no escape that the EU is part of the order of things, like it or lump it. And up to a point, he's quite right. There is a much more positive case to make. The neglect of that more persuasive case, in part because of the arrogance of those who won the referendum in 1975, and the inexplicit way in which they presented the issue which was at stake at that point, contributed mightily to the present lassitude verging on hostility which the British show for Europe. On the other hand, the inevitability argument is right, for a very good reason. There is no other inevitability available. Why be ashamed of it? It isn't proof of a nation's feeble-minded passivity, but of the adult acceptance by the British that the status quo established 25 years ago cannot be fundamentally challenged. This is the message, not least, of those who dare not openly advocate exit. It's the only conclusion to draw from the failure of the sceptics to deliver a rival narrative. Must we keep struggling to find a new story when the old one is now well embedded in our lives? What Europe can mean for good on the continent and the offshore island needs to be better proclaimed. Mr. Blair has started doing this. The reluctance to do it, seen in all pro-Europe Tory ministers for many years, and still in many Labour ministers now, is part of the tyranny of scepticism, the bullying by the press, inducing a timidity in making the case, which has drained the Europe cause of most of its idealism, as if, among other things, one of its founding purposes, the avoidance of war, has become a laughable irrelevance. That takes me back to where I started. The first lecture in the People's Europe series should not have been about this subject at all. It should have been about what Britain can do in Europe, how the idealism of the founders can be reinterpreted today, how the ongoing and, I think, indestructible experiment in this unique form of governance between nation states can best be continued, how Britain, the member with the longest continuous experience of democracy, can bring wisdom to bear in a union where few other members could hope to play a leadership role. But those debates cannot begin. Until the existential question is settled, any British politician who tries to start them risks being shouted down before the first sentence is out of their mouth. Adult discussion of these great questions is stifled in the mother of parliaments by reductionist charges of hidden agendas and other devices for either preempting the referendum or influencing the climate in which it's held. Euroscepticism, inadequately challenged, bequeaths us this irony. Under the present terms of political trade, there can be no mature British debate about the future of Europe until the great national question has been settled. That is a reason to start the dismantling without apology and without delay. Thank you.